From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. According to right-wing libertarians and free market economists, the unfettered market leads to freedom from domination, and there's no better expression of such freedom than the private enterprise. My guest today, philosopher Elizabeth Anderson, believes such notion couldn't be further from the truth. In her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It, published by Princeton University Press, Anderson argues that in the workplace we have almost no rights. She's professor of philosophy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Before we turn to the workplace, Elizabeth, let me start by asking you about the history of ideas celebrating the free market, which we associate with the libertarian right. You argue that they had more egalitarian origins in the 17th century, in the very early days of capitalism in England. Tell us about that history.
Yes, exactly. So I trace free market ideas back to the levelers during the English Civil War, which happened around the 1640s. The levelers, as you could guess from their name, were an egalitarian group, although they didn't believe in leveling down as we understand it today in terms of the equal distribution of property. But they did believe in equalizing privileges. So the levelers argued against the House of Lords. They wanted to abolish aristocratic privilege. They wanted to abolish the monopoly that the great landowners had over land in those days. Inheritance of land was based on primogeniture and entail. These were laws that said that the great estates could not be broken up into smaller estates and sold off on a free market, but rather the estate would be passed down whole to the firstborn son of each aristocratic family. So there was a monopoly on land that was held by the lords, and then there was a monopoly on trade that was basically bought by the great manufacturers. And all the small craftsmen had to do the bidding of the big manufacturers in these guilds. It was really the big shots who made all the rules about who could trade, where and when they could trade, how much they could trade, what prices and so forth. And obviously those rules were all rigged in favor of the big manufacturers. And an ordinary small producer really had no recourse but to follow the rules that the big shots held. And so from their point of view, breaking up monopoly and opening up trade to anyone who wanted to participate was a huge egalitarian advance. It leveled the playing field between large and small manufacturers, between yeoman farmers and great landlords. And most importantly, it would open up opportunities for self-employment to large numbers of people. So the levelers were vividly aware that the employment relationship in those days, it was called the relationship of master and servant, was a relation of domination between the masters who were superior and who could order around the inferiors. And levelers such as Lilburn and Hewell argued that if you opened up trade, free trade, to everyone, that lots more people could become self-employed. They'd be their own bosses. They wouldn't have to answer to someone who lorded it over them. And so that would result in a general liberation of the working classes.
So the key thing here then is that when they were thinking about work and the conditions of work, they were picturing people who were working for themselves. Is that right?
That's what they were hoping that the free market would deliver. And you can see that theme, that opening up free market and free trade would open up opportunities for self-employment, carried forth continuously through other free market thinkers, including Adam Smith, the great author of The Wealth of Nations and a great founder of classical economics. Tom Paine, the great American revolutionary. You can see this theme of self-employment all the way up to the eve of the Civil War, promoted by the Republican Party and its leader, Abraham Lincoln. They all thought opening up for free trade would enable everyone to be self-employed, or at least dramatically expand the ranks of the self-employed. And so the employment relation would just shrivel to a tiny marginal affair that people, maybe when they just started out in life, they would be a farmhand or a servant for a couple of years, but very rapidly acquire enough savings so that they could set themselves up in business for themselves, mostly in farming, but they might become professionals or craftspeople as well.
So what then happened? What was the reality as market society took hold, as capitalism developed from the 17th century, when we were talking about the levelers, to the emergence of the Industrial Revolution?
Right. So the big thing that happened, why don't we roll back a little bit and think about Adam Smith's argument, because his argument was really pivotal from an economic point of view. He argued that the great landlords were actually very inefficient at farming because they couldn't be bothered with the details. The great landlords, they're aristocrats, they're busy consuming luxuries and holding balls, but they were not good businessmen because they didn't, you know, they had a monopoly on land, and so the rents were just pouring in without them having to lift a finger. He thought that they were lazy and stupid and were not able, not inclined to attend to the kind of details needed to increase efficiency of production. The manufacturers were all monopolists, and so while they were pretty crafty and smart, they really wanted to just collect monopoly rents rather than improving efficiency of production. So on Smith's view, if you broke up the monopolies and you forced people to compete, the natural unit of production would be the self-employed business person, because that person would have a huge incentive to work very efficiently the capital that they owned. The yeoman farmer who just owned his own family farm had a far greater incentive to invest carefully in the land and work it efficiently than landlords or slaves or tenants who had to, or sharecroppers who had to pay half of everything they grew to the landowner. The person who had the greatest incentive to work hard and efficiently would be the person who got to keep 100% of the fruits of his labor. And that would be a self-employed person. The employee didn't really have that much of an incentive to work hard and efficiently, because a certain portion of the fruits of the employee's labor would go to his employer. So why work hard? The whole argument depends on the background assumption that economies of scale don't really make much of a difference. There are not really big economies of scale, and indeed, Smith argued that quite explicitly. He said there were only a few cases in which economies of scale, where you need massive concentrations of capital to get the enterprise going, mattered. He pointed out, well, maybe canals were like that. You build a canal, it takes a lot of investment. So there are economies of scale with canals. But he said, precisely for that reason, it's very routine business. It really didn't matter whether you had private enterprise or whether you had the government running a canal. You'd land in the same place. So he thought, yeah, there's a couple industries where maybe you had economies of scale, but the rest, it was the self-employed worker who had the greatest incentive, who would work the hardest and the smartest. And so under free market competition, capital ownership would devolve to the self-employed business person. Everybody would be self-employed. Everyone would only own enough capital that they could work with their own hands, and maybe a temporary worker or two who would then go on to build their own enterprise. So all enterprises would be small, and that meant that wealth would be roughly equally divided among everyone, and that everyone would be free and equal because they wouldn't have to answer to a boss. That was the picture, and the Industrial Revolution is what destroyed that picture. because you have giant spinning factories, and then later on in the second half of the Industrial Revolution, you have giant iron foundries and so forth. These are huge operations. Railroads, they required huge agglomerations of capital, far beyond the capacity of any single worker to accumulate. And once you get huge scale, you need many hands to work these large concentrations of capital. So it's inevitable that you end up with an employment relationship where you have a few capital owners who are really rich, they own the enterprise, and they hire the workers. So what the free market ultimately delivered was a massive degradation of the standard of freedom of the worker, because now the workers were even deeper under the thumb of their employers than before. So the free market prediction of pre-industrial revolution theorists got turned on its head, and inequality just expanded rather than contracting under the free market.
How did that affect free market thinking then in the 19th century, when clearly the predictions turned out quite differently? Did it change the ideas that people who had been celebrating the free market held?
Well, at that point, then free market thinking kind of diverted. So in the 19th century, what you get is, with the notable exception of John Stuart Mill, a move towards a kind of rationalization of the domination of workers by their employers at the hands of theorists from Thomas Malthus to Herbert Spencer. And you had the great era in the 19th century of class conflict. So on the one hand, you had the pro-capitalists who became quite anti-egalitarian and basically said, you know, the poverty and subordination of the workers was socially necessary, desirable, and just what they deserved. And then the left basically ended up rejecting the market, and it moved over to the labor market, to revolution under Marxism or various forms of socialism, or the organization of labor unions. And the one holdout was John Stuart Mill, writing in the mid to late 19th century. He was the last of the great classical economists. And what he hoped would result from the Industrial Revolution was workers being able to collect into cooperatives and collectively own and manage the firm. And that was a hope that he had, that workers would all prefer that arrangement. But in the end, that arrangement was a very marginal thing in the 19th century. And a large part of the cause was just that the amount of capital that had to be raised in order to own a competitive firm just far exceeded the capacity of ordinary workers to save up for.
That's the voice of philosopher Elizabeth Anderson. We're talking about her book, Private Government: How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It, published by Princeton University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then, taking things up to the present, where obviously free market ideas are the ideas of the right, especially the libertarian right, and following those ideas, not only does the free market perpetuate freedom, it perpetuates freedom through these different enterprises, private enterprises, which are crucial units within a market system. You, on the other hand, make the argument that our places of employment, workplaces, are not the realm of freedom, but quite the opposite. Tell us why that is.
Yes. So even if you go back to the levelers, they recognized government. And they thought that government was everywhere. You have government wherever you have some people issuing orders to other people that they can back up with sanctions for disobedience, carrots and sticks, over some domain of activity, more or less unified domain. So the levelers were vividly aware that husbands governed their wives, that school teachers governed their pupils, that employers governed their employees. It was at the hands of the master that the journeymen worked. They took orders from the master, and if they performed poorly by the master's judgment, then they would be punished. Their wages could be docked. And indeed, back in those days, and indeed all the way up in America until the mid-19th century, workers were paid at the end of a year. They were under contract for an entire year. And the employer had the right to withhold any or all wages for 365 days for the slightest infraction of any work rule in any single day. So a worker who failed to show up on day 365 or failed to absolutely obey the stringent instructions or turn in work of lesser quality than expected for just one day could have all 365 days of wages docked.
Astounding.
Imagine that. So it didn't mean that workers starved, because in those days, workers lived in the household of their employer. There was really no other way, because transportation just took too long. So you had to live nearby your employer, and most of them lived in the household of their employer.
It sounds like a very complicated arrangement. And then in our times, with a modern industrial firm, what rights do we give up when we enter into an employment relation?
Right. So I've just characterized the employment relation as a governance relationship where bosses govern workers. And that's just as true today as it was back then, although we're lucky enough now to live in houses that are separate from our bosses. So
indeed,
at least when we're off work, most of the time our employers don't meddle with us. However, under contemporary employment law in the United States, the default rule is something that's known as employment at will. And employment at will means that your boss can fire you for any or no reason at all. And there's only a tiny number of exceptions to the employment at will rule. Most of those exceptions having to do with discrimination. So your boss can't fire you because of your race, your gender, disability status, age, and so forth. There's only a tiny number of reasons why you can't be fired, but the employer can fire you for any other reason, or just because, you know, the employer just gets angry, or, you know, just had a stomach ache, right? Some arbitrary non-reason, and fire someone just in a fit of pique. Now, what that means is, under employment at will, that in fact, workers cede virtually all of their rights to their employer, because their employer could fire them for any kind of reason that they just don't like about the person. And that could even extend over into their private conduct. So you get off duty, and maybe you do something that the employer doesn't like. For instance, maybe you have a same-sex partner, or maybe you go drinking with your friends and your boss is a teetotaler and doesn't like that. Well, you could be fired for that. Any kind of private conduct, even off duty, is subject to firing at the hands of the employer. And of course, on duty also, there's very minute control that bosses exercise over their workers in many workplaces. So in the research that I found, we have some pretty outrageous cases. Turns out that most of the poultry workers in the United States, these are the ones who work in the slaughterhouses, are not allowed to use the bathroom for their entire 8-hour shift. When they complain, the boss just tells them to show up at work wearing diapers.
That is astounding. And these workers, are there no labor laws about them having breaks sometime within those 8 hours?
Well, according to OSHA, the Regulatory Workplace Safety Agency, Every employer has to supply a bathroom. However, they don't have to supply enough bathrooms so that everyone gets a chance to go to the bathroom on break. And indeed, it's taken so long even to get the right to have a bathroom that OSHA took a long time after that to issue a regulation that once the bathroom was there, workers had a right to use it. And that right is still widely disrespected in a number of industries, including slaughterhouses.
Are there differences of the degree to which domination is exercised against workers depending on status and pay? I'm thinking upper middle class professionals work many, many hours, but their conditions of work may be different than people who are in lower paid, say, service sector jobs.
That's an excellent point. So you are right that the professional managerial class is in many of them are working all the time. And I can speak for personal experience. I'm chair of my department. Basically, I have no leisure anymore. All of my work, right? You know, there are so many demands on me just as an academic administrator now chairing my department that there's almost no time to do to have any leisure at all. So that's a very common phenomenon for the professional managerial class. They got to bring salaried workers. They bring work home with them. They have to be on email all the time. However, I'm not going to shed too many tears for the upper tier of workers, because they also get a lot of prestige, a lot of autonomy, meaningful work, high salaries, benefits, and so forth. So I'm not complaining on my own behalf. Much worse conditions are faced by the mass of lower paid workers. Let's keep in mind that the median individual salary in the United States, or annual wage, is about $30,000 a year. So we're talking about people who are financially straitened. And what that means is they really have to put up with mountains of abuse because they don't have the kinds of mobility options that most members of the professional managerial class have.
Right, because one of the things that could brought up here is, well, if you have a job where your boss is a jerk or it's oppressive, you know, go find another job. Why can't you just do that? Why is that not the answer?
Well, you could take a look at restaurant workers, people who serve tables. 90% of them have experienced sexual harassment at work. Okay, so what restaurant are you going to exit to? Even if by chance you land in one of the 1 in 10 restaurants where people haven't yet experienced sexual harassment, that gives you no security at all that tomorrow your boss might not decide to sexually harass you. That's what the system is like. The form of government of the workplace isn't just any ordinary government. It's a dictatorship. It's arbitrary government. The employer can do pretty much anything to you, and your only recourse is to quit.
Well, let me ask you more about sexual harassment. Obviously, women can harass men.
Yes.
And it's not just men who can harass women, but clearly in the recent wave of people coming forward and talking about being harassed, often it's not described as a labor issue, even though a lot of these things are taking place where someone has domination over another person. You state that the authoritarian power of employers has roots in patriarchal rights over the household preceding the Industrial Revolution, and then it moved from the household to the firm. Does that leave any legacies? Is there any connection between the two, or am I making a big jump there?
No, you're completely correct. So traditionally, because workers, the journeymen and the apprentices lived in a kind of extended family of the household, and same with butlers and all kinds of domestic servants. And even tenant farmers lived on the great estates of the landlords, and the landlords treated them as really part of their household and under their dominion as patriarchs. So you're completely accurate about that. And that was part of the ideology of patriarchy, of course, is that the the head of the household, you know, has arbitrary rule over all subordinate members of the household, his wife, children, servants. You could read this directly in John Locke. Locke actually, ironically, opposed that. He was a feminist of his day, and he thought that wives didn't really have to knuckle under their husbands, except for a small number of areas. But the norm was that subordinate members of any household had to knuckle under, and that's what patriarchy was all about. And ironically, even after the Industrial Revolution separated the place of work from people's homes, you know, where they slept and ate, those traditional patriarchal norms and understandings of the authority that the employer had over the worker kind of continued without much change. Workers gained a few rights, but a lot less than you might expect, because those old assumptions that the boss got to govern the worker continued. So you could look in the early days of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, when Henry Ford adopted his famous high wage rate for assembly line workers for his cars. That wage rate was tied to workers exhibiting good behavior. And he established something known as the sociological department, which was kind of a human resources department that would actually visit the workers' homes to make sure that they kept them neat and clean, that they used the bathtub correctly, that they ate American food, not European-style food, because many of them were immigrants, that they didn't send too much of their wages to their family members who were still abroad. They had huge numbers of regulations for how workers ought to behave in their private lives.
You know, one might think Henry Ford was a bit of a nut, and that kind of control seems so hard to imagine. But you're arguing that actually contemporary employers do affect our personal lives and our work lives in ways that I think a lot of us don't spend much time thinking about, or thinking of being the result of a particular arrangement and a particular relation of domination and subordination. And earlier you gave some examples, but of course, political activities are something that you could get fired
yes.
over.
Yes.
Not so, exercising would be another.
Right. So one of the things that's happened is employers now are acting as public health authorities over their workers. Under the Affordable Care Act, there were certain changes that were made in regulation of employer-covered health care plans. And one of them was that workers could suffer a 30% surcharge on their monthly health insurance premium if they did not join an employer-sponsored wellness program. Those wellness programs often involve diet programs, exercise, smoking cessation, require workers to reveal personal details about their lives, such as whether they use birth control or plan to have children or have sexual dysfunction. Do you really want to be revealing that kind of information to your employer? I think it's none of the employer's business. But as a de facto public health authority, they're entitled to force workers to divulge that kind of information.
And yet, these sorts of intrusions are so pervasive that it seems like a lot of people don't actually question them and question the arrangement.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of just accept that this is what you got to do in order to get a job or remain employed. Here's another example. A huge percentage of workers in the United States are subject to pressure from their employer to contribute to political campaigns or political action committees that are run by the corporation or favored by the employer. My husband, who's a physician at Henry Ford Health System, a giant, a sprawling healthcare system with multiple clinics and hospitals in Southeast Michigan, he gets pressured every campaign season to contribute to the political action committee of his employer. He's told how, what causes are favored by the employer and which candidates and so forth. And he feels a certain degree of intimidation. A lot of professional managerial workers, but even hourly workers are pressured in this way, sometimes to show up at campaign events to ostensibly support candidates that they might not really support. And they feel, many of them feel intimidated because if they don't show up, is this going to be a mark against them? Campaign contributions are traceable by anybody. They're a matter of public record. The employer could check up and see whether an employee has made the contributions that were encouraged by the boss. It's a very intimidating thing.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Today, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Anderson. She's professor of philosophy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. We're discussing her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. That's published by Princeton University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So I want to ask you, given all the things that you've been enumerating take place in our workplaces that you argue allow for a tremendous amount of domination in the workplace to the point that you're labeling the workplace a private government, what allows the state of affairs to happen where workers cede most of their rights when they take a job?
It all comes down to employment at will. If your employer can fire you for any or no reason, your employer can issue pretty much any order he or she wants to you and threaten you with, if not firing, then demotion, pay cuts, harassment, abuse, any form of intimidation that will get you to comply with the boss's preferences.
So would you argue then that workers who are not at-will employees are not governed by their bosses?
So the government remains, but say you are represented by a labor union, then you have someone to complain to and your union rep can bring up complaints. You get some procedural protections against arbitrary handling and abuse. I'm not saying labor unions are perfect, but they certainly give workers a voice and some representation in the firm. And so workers represented by unions are less subject to abuse and domination than those who are not.
Right. But of course, particularly in the United States right now, very few people are in unions. And even within a union, you'd be constrained by the terms of the contract.
That's quite correct. And of course, unions do have their problems. So we do know, for instance, that it's been very difficult even for workers represented by a union to get any recourse if they suffer sexual harassment at the hands of coworkers. That's been a big problem. There's a lot of sexism in unions. Not all unions. Some of them are actually really outstanding on these issues, but some of them are pretty problematic.
But nonetheless, very few people in the United States are represented by
Correct.
Unions.
That's right. And that is a product of our laws regulating the formation of unions. And there are different rules in different countries. So if some countries, people get the protections of labor union contracts, even if they're not a member. In France, for instance, the rates of unionization in the private sector are not much higher than in the United States, but collective bargaining takes place on an industry-wide level. And consequently, even workplaces that have no union get some of the benefits of collective bargaining that is undertaken by a small percentage of unionized workers. So there are lots of countries that have a regime like that. Now, there are pluses and minuses of that kind of regime. But it shows you that in some places, even with small percentages of people in unions, they can get a lot of leverage on behalf of workers generally. In the United States, the labor law is written in such a way that unions are pretty much confined just to bargaining within their unit, which could be very small.
Indeed. Why have struggles over the length of the workday been crucial to the struggle over worker domination within firms?
That's a really great question. If we go back to the 19th century, the biggest issue and the workers' movement in the 19th century was not wages, it was the length of the working day. When you had people who had to work 12 hours a day, you could imagine they had barely enough time to get up, eat breakfast, drag themselves to work, work a whole shift, go home, catch a quick bite to eat, and then fall asleep so that they would have enough energy for the next day. They had no leisure at all. They were under the thumb of their bosses at work pretty much their entire lives. And so if you look, for instance, in the United States, and there were similar movements all across Europe, the Knights of Labor, late 19th century labor movement organization in the United States, called for an 8-hour working day. And their slogan was, you have 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours to do what you wanted with yourself. That was freedom, right? Finally, you get a chunk of the day where you actually have the leisure, the freedom, and the energy to do with that time, with that big chunk of your life, what you wanted to do with it. It's liberation.
Do you think that struggles over the length of the workday could be an important fight around the questions you're talking about the ways that workers' lives are dominated by their employers?
Well, today I think the struggles over the timing of work have shifted somewhat. It is true that the professional managerial class is working all the time, and that's definitely an issue for them. But I'm thinking more about hourly workers and the uncertainty of the hours they get from week to week. So a huge percentage of hourly workers cannot count on full-time work from week to week. And they don't even know what hours they're going to get until, you know, a little bit ahead of time. It makes it impossible for them to plan their lives. It could be that they're called for a few hours in the morning and then they're let off with no pay for several hours in the afternoon. But if they have a long commute, it means they can't really spend any leisure back home. They're hanging around with junk time on their hands that isn't paid, with nothing to do, no friends and family nearby to enjoy it with. And if they have shifting schedules from week to week, it means that it's almost impossible to schedule care for their children. Because then their caretakers would have to shift from week to week, and maybe that's not possible. It also means that they can't plan for higher education. You can't sign up for a college course and pay all that tuition and then find that your boss has decided that the hours that your class is meeting, your boss wants you to show up and work. So the fluctuating hours, the uncertainty of wages, fluctuating income, lots of junk time, inability to plan ahead for regular child care, for leisure time, for college classes or other forms of self-improvement, right? All those opportunities get shot because of an uncertainty in the scheduling of work.
What role does the state play in this state of affairs where workers are dominated by their employers at work?
That's a really important issue because, according to free market ideology, the theory goes, well, this is just a free contract between the worker and the employer, and they could tailor it to the to terms that are mutually acceptable to both parties. But that forgets that the state plays a critical role in defining the default contract of the workplace, which is employment at will. It's the employment at will regime that hands enormous amounts of arbitrary power to the employer. And it's the state that rigs the game in this way. The employer holds all the power cards, all the authority cards. And so if you hand one party all the cards and the other party now has to enter a negotiation, what are the chances that the employer is going to deal cards to the worker? Well, for a few highly talented, very scarce workers, maybe they will get a few cards. But for your ordinary, easily replaceable worker where there's dozens of people in line to get that job and hundreds of applications to sort through, the employer just figures they're going to offer the lowest possible terms with the least amount of freedom. And workers just have to put up with it because they have to eat and take care of their families. So the state is ultimately responsible for the form of the contract and the default form of governance in the workplace. And it's the state that's decided that the form of government of the workplace is a dictatorship where the employer has arbitrary power over the employee, not only on duty, but even off duty.
Elizabeth Anderson is my guest. We're talking about her book, Private Government, and I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. How does looking at the place of work, as well as this longer history that you've traced about how the proponents of the free market have seen the workplace, how does it change our understanding of domination? Because much of the discourse about domination and freedom in this country does not include workplaces at all. The way that they are framed is that, especially particularly on the right, is to do with freedom from the state. So do you think that we should be sort of upending our that understanding of domination?
Absolutely. So what I want to argue is that when we talk about government, most people are just talking about the state. And what I'm arguing is, and this is an argument explicitly directed against libertarians, libertarians talk that way because their ideology was formed before the Industrial Revolution. It was formed at a time where they anticipated that the upshot of completely free markets, the upshot of abolishing all monopoly, would be that the state would be the only remaining form of government because everyone would be self-employed. They'd be their own boss. They wouldn't have to take orders from an employer. That prediction did not pan out, but libertarians in their rhetoric never updated their beliefs to reflect that. So they remain narrowly focused on the government of the state, and they rail against government and arbitrary government and how it restrains our liberties, but they fail to recognize that the scope of government lies far beyond the state, and it includes the workplace. So my argument to libertarians is, if you're skeptical of government and the way it constrains our liberties, you ought to be skeptical of the employment relation, which is another kind of government, which, unlike our state, local, and federal government, is not democratic. It's a form of government where the people being governed don't have any voice. They don't have a right to a voice or a vote, right? It's undemocratic. It's a dictatorship. This is what I call private government. It's government that's kept private from the governed, in the sense that the governors say it's none of your business what orders we give. So it's private from the people being governed, and I think that's objectionable.
Well, thinking about the private enterprise, the workplace, as a place where a kind of governing takes place, aside from making the change that people would not be at-will employees who would be subject to being fired with, you know, no recourse, are there other changes that could happen at the level of the workplace? I mean, you've mentioned unionization, but I'm talking about actually within the structure of the workplace that would address this problem at its root, because it seems like you're arguing that people need to have more leverage, workers Yep. within a workplace, they need to have more leverage, say through a union, trying to limit the power of the employer over them. Is there
Right.
some deeper way, though, that the whole workplace relationship could be reconfigured?
Yes. So what I argue in my book is that it's time to rethink the constitution of government of the workplace. labor unions have their place, but one of the defects of labor union law in the United States is workers have to put the union up for an election, right? There has to be an election to be represented. And that opens up the scope for all kinds of intimidation, and some companies just shut down any part of the workplace where the workers have decided to unionize. So it turns out that it's very difficult to establish a union, and even if it is elected, workers just ignore it with impunity, and it's very difficult to force them to bargain in good faith. So my view is we should look over to Europe, which has an alternative system that runs parallel to labor unions. And many of these countries have a system that's known as co-determination. Under co-determination, the constitution of government of the workplace is fixed in advance and automatically includes representation of workers in the management of the workplace. As soon as a workplace gets to be 50 workers or more, workers automatically get a representative that has a hand in management. So they're not just bargaining externally for wages and benefits. They're actually part of management, and they make managerial decisions jointly with representatives of the owners of the firm. And I think that could do a lot to protect workers against abuse, even if they're not represented by a labor union. They'll still have a voice in management, which can call out bosses for, you know, all kinds of abusive behavior and say, you know, you can't do that. And indeed, some of the managers will be workers, that is, representatives of workers, accountable to them. So they're going to have a strong reason not to impose harsh and abusive conditions.
But going a step further, since your work focuses on these social relations of power, what about doing away with the distinction between bosses and workers? What about workplace cooperatives? How about that as another model?
Sure. I mean, look, it would be great if we could have more worker-owned and operated cooperatives. That was John Stuart Mill's hope. My point of caution is it's not obvious that we can pull that off for a lot of workplaces. For some workplaces, the scale of the enterprise is simply too vast for workers to actually own it. Think about huge things like universities and hospitals and airlines. It's really hard to figure out how workers could collect enough capital to actually own the enterprise, or a giant hotel or casino or something. They're just too big. And even if they could gather enough capital to own the enterprise collectively, it's probably not a prudent investment to put all your eggs in one basket, both your employment eggs and your savings eggs. If that enterprise were to go bankrupt, the workers would be left penniless without either a job or any savings to fall back on. So it's not obvious to me that the worker cooperative, I mean, it sounds really great, and there are some successful ones, and I wish them well. But it's not obvious to me that that really is the best setup for workers. And that's why I think something like co-determination could make a lot of sense and is worth bringing over from Europe to the United States.
It seems like in discussing the workplace itself, where, you know, market societies were distinguished by things becoming commodities, including labor. So you sell your labor to an employer as a commodity. Do you think that is at the crux of the problem, whether or not that could be changed fundamentally, being a separate one?
Well, I think there is a classic critique of the employment relationship, which is based directly on commodification, because once people become commodities, you know, maybe they're not owned as in slavery, but they're rented, and then they lose all their liberty. Mm-hmm. However, under a system of co-determination, that really amounts to substantial decommodification of the employment relationship, because then workers have a guaranteed voice in management, so they are to that extent self-governing. And there's all kinds of work rules to protect workers against abuse, to protect their privacy and autonomy, both on and off the job. It looks less and less like a form of commodification and more an arrangement of, you know, joint governance in which workers have some autonomy, some voice, and in which they're, you know, you just have a cooperative relationship with some degree of, you know, managerial hierarchy, but something that is more like a representative democracy. Not so bad.
I've been speaking with political philosopher Elizabeth Anderson. We're talking about her book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include The Imperative of Integration. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.